Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. How often have you thought or talked about the weather this week? It is really difficult not to, given we've all been surrounded by heat. The entire weekend just sweltered, but Sacramento hit 109 degrees on Sunday, and that broke an 88-year record set back in 1935. And we're not alone. Extreme heat is coating the United States, Europe, and Asia. And this follows the Earth just having its hottest June on record, according to NOAA. If it feels like we've been here before, it's because we have. Breaking records is becoming a norm with devastating consequences. Last summer's heat wave in Europe killed more than 60,000 people, according to the academic journal Nature. While forecasts typically focus on the immediate days ahead, we're going to take a long view. Claudia Tibaldi is a scientist at the Joint Global Change Research Institute and has been studying increasingly frequent and longer lasting heat waves for more than 20 years. Welcome.
Hi, Vicky. Thank you for having me and for the opportunity of talking to your audience.
Thank you for taking the time. It's an important conversation and a timely one at that. What led to you studying extremes and climate change?
Well, in 2003, somebody may remember, there was a big heat wave hitting Europe. Paris was at the epicenter of that heat wave. And at the time I was starting my career, and my mentor, who was interested in general about, you know, projections of climate change, we thought of focusing on heat waves in particular. And we chose the Paris heat wave sort of as an example, as a template to then go and interrogate our climate models for what this type of events would become in the future. And that led to a paper that was one of the first ones to tackle this issue. And that was in 2004. And yeah. I was actually thinking about the fact that at the time we used the word extreme as a synonym of rare. But unfortunately, this is no longer the case. Extremes are no longer rare.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, when going back, you know, nearly 20 years ago, that paper in 2004, it was published in Science, and the title was More Intense, More Frequent, and Longer Lasting Heat Waves in the 21st Century. That actually led to you testifying before a Senate panel about climate change. Did you see this coming 20 years ago, us having this conversation now, as there's really regional heat waves happening across the world?
At the time, it appeared like, you know, a problem far in the future, and it has been kind of humbling and concerning to be faced with, as you were mentioning, this repeating of these problems year after year, season after season. So I guess the pace and the intensity that we observe in the last few years has caught many of us by surprise.
Given that this is your field of study and one that you have really been knee deep in for decades, you know, there are just so many headlines from around the world about the heat. I mean, obviously we feel it immediately. We're here in Sacramento, but then you brought it in. You're like, oh, the Southwest is going through a heat wave, and then Europe as well, and Asia. When you read these headlines or take this news in, you know, how I would imagine you have a deeper understanding of why this is happening.
Well, there is a very simple explanation, at least, of the general tendencies of what we are seeing. So just the fact that the world is warming on average makes these events more likely, and when they happen, more extreme, because what we see as a warming in general translates into warmer extremes as well. So that is, of course, the simpler explanation. But some of these events are so intense, so unprecedented, that require more than just that explanation. And that is where, you know, our science still needs to advance, still needs to investigate more deeply what's at what is taking place here. And the reason is that we are warming the planet. And as we know, the planet is a complicated system where everything is interconnected. So just the warming causes changes, for example, in the circulation that create, I'm sure people have heard of these high pressure domes where, you know, the air becomes stagnant day after day and creates these effects of, you know, overheated temperatures over a certain region without escape. So, but those effects are more complicated to both model and predict. So there is more work to be done.
So, I mean, learning that, I mean, it's obviously interconnected when we're talking about the climate and our atmosphere. So these heat waves, they're not just coincidental. They're all connected. They're taking place at the same time all over the world.
Yes, the IPCC that has written a report recently has you know, made it clear that it's not only an increase in frequency and intensity of this event, but it's an increase in the likelihood of them happening at the same time. And that, of course, creates problems also, for example, if we think of, you know, our food supply system, where heat waves that may happen at the same time in different bread baskets could cause, you know, shortage of food around the world. And of course, we see things happening not only in terms of heat, but as you well know, we are seeing at the same time extremes in precipitation all around the world, in the US, in South Korea, in India. So we are really amping up the system, and some of these behaviors are, you know, unprecedented and at a certain level unpredictable. Of course, we have also El Nino now that is a natural phenomena, but we know can superimpose its effects to this, to these warming tendencies, and we're really in a new world, in the sense that every year is a new state of the system that we are experimenting with, which is fairly scary.
Are there parts of the world that concern you the most, or more than others?
Well, I should say that, you know, one of the fortunate things about working where I work is that we don't limit our studies to the physical climate system. We look at how the hazard that the physical climate system brings about impacts society, the economy, the natural world. And we know that the final effects of these events are not only just a function of what happens in the climate, but it's a function, they are a function of, you know, the preparedness of society, the resources that we can bring to face this phenomena. So to get to your question, of course, we are most concerned about, you know, the poor, which can be the poor countries of the world, but also the poor, you know, segments of our societies in our developed countries. Those are the people that, first of all, are more exposed. For example, you know, workers that work outdoors are more prevalent in developing world economies. And so there is more exposure to these extreme events in those countries, but also in our economies, the workers outdoor are usually those that have less means to face these problems. So there is more exposure, and of course there is more vulnerability because there are not the resources that our rich societies can put to facing these events.
Well, Claudia, thank you for the time and your continued work on this topic.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity.
Claudia Tibaldi is a scientist at the Joint Global Change Research Institute. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about increasingly frequent and longer lasting heat waves across California, the country, and the world. So the heat can be brutally uncomfortable, but the reality is it can also be dangerous. Given the ongoing heat wave, CalOSHA, that's the state's agency which focuses on workplace safety, they announced that they are ramping up resources for those who have to work outside.
And our team is out in full force right now conducting targeted inspections to ensure employers are complying with the law, with a focus on construction, agriculture, tree trimming, landscaping, car wash, and warehouse industries.
And the state says it's also focusing on the most vulnerable residents with its Heat Ready campaign that is in multiple languages.
We are focusing on communities who are most at risk, including our older adults, our young children, those with chronic health conditions, persons with disabilities, those who are pregnant, and people in urban communities.
A tragically common and preventable consequence of hot temperatures are heat stroke deaths inside vehicles. They happen every year, often killing children and pets, and there have been 12 so far killing children this year alone across the country. That number comes from a database created by a meteorologist who is based at San Jose State University. Joining us now is Jan Nall, the founder of NoHeatStroke.org. Good morning.
Good morning, Vicki.
Well, before we dive in to this organization, NoHeatStroke.org, you were a meteorologist at the National Weather Service for 25 years. With that experience in forecasting, how have heat waves changed?
You know, we're seeing more of them, and everything going on in the atmosphere right now has some, you know, climate change DNA in it. It's hard to pick out exactly which one would have happened anyway, but we are seeing more of these events. And just like we had a stagnant weather pattern this past winter, which made us so wet, now we're into another stagnant weather pattern, shorter term, where we've had these areas of high pressure across the Southwest and in through the Southeast, and with extended periods of hot weather there.
Hmm. When did you get involved in studying and preventing, you know, heat stroke deaths in vehicles that primarily affect children?
So I first got involved back in 2001. I had a phone call from a member of the media in San Jose who there had been the death of a five-month-old child, Kyle Patrick Gilbert, who'd been left in a car. And he asked me, well, Jan, how hot could have gotten in that car? And I go, well, I don't know, but I'll Google that. Somebody's done a study. Well, nobody had really done anything very comprehensive. So I started keeping track of temperatures in my own car. I did a controlled study the next summer 2002, where I looked at days between 72 and 96 degrees and kept track of temperatures out through 1 hour in 10-minute increments. Ended up working with a couple ER doctors from Stanford, and we published that in that study in the American Academy of Pediatrics in 2005, and it has literally become the go-to study in the world on the topic.
Mm. So how hot can cars get, and how fast?
Very hot, very fast. In the first 10 minutes, a car heats up 19 degrees. So let's say it's a typical summer day in Sacramento of 90 degrees. In 10 minutes, that car is 109 degrees. For a small infant child, that can be a lethal temperature. After an hour, temperatures rise about 45 degrees above whatever your starting temperature was. So our 90-degree Sacramento day in the summer, we're now at 135 inside that car. That's hotter than the hottest day ever in Death Valley.
And given that these are preventable, but yet they continue to happen, do you have a better understanding of why they happen? Are people just leaving children in cars thinking that, you know, it's generally safe and unaware that it can get so hot so fast?
So these instances fall into three broad categories. The largest category, a little over 50% of the cases, are where children are accidentally forgotten in a car. A parent or caregiver gets distracted in some way. They can be overtired. They can be talking on their cell phone when they're getting out of the car, forget the child out. They think someone else is getting the child out of the car. Then the next category for about 25% of the cases are where children get into a vehicle on their own. Last week, a six-year-old in Florida died inside a hot car. He got inside a car, was overcome by the heat, and died from that. There's strategies, and we can talk about these in a moment, about sort of how to prevent some of these things. And then the third and probably the saddest category, where about 20% of the cases where a parent or caregiver thinks it's okay to leave the child in their car while they go run an errand. I mean, it may be an appointment. It may be going to going to a casino or going to a bar or meeting up with somebody. And, as we talked about how quickly cars heat up, that's never safe.
When it comes to the symptoms and how fast this can happen, I mean, you call it's pediatric vehicular heat stroke. That's the formal name of it. What symptoms should people look out for if, say, maybe they forgot that they left their child in a car, it's been a few minutes, they rush back to their vehicle, and they want to assess their child to make sure that they're okay?
So the clinical definition for heat stroke is when the body temperature gets to be about 104 degrees. And that's when the body starts going into this let's try and save ourselves mode. One of the things it does is it stops perspiring. So if you see a child who has a flushed face, but they're not sweating, they have a dry forehead, that's the first thing that first responder looks for and say, okay, this is heat stroke. We need to treat it much more seriously than, well, this child is sweaty and just overheating. When a child's body temperature gets to be 107 degrees, not that much more above, we've already gone up from normal up to 104, about 6 degrees. Now we're only going up another 3 degrees. At 107, cells inside the body stop functioning. And then organs shut down, and you have this cascade. And unfortunately, death can happen very, very rapidly. And especially small infants and children, where they are, often in a car seat. We all cool ourselves by perspiration. Well, if you're sitting in a car seat or in any type of seat, your back, your buttocks, and your thighs, they're not evaporating. That perspiration is sitting there and staying hot. We cool off by the perspiration on our arms and other parts of our bodies evaporating. We get that evaporating cooling to the body. So these things happen much faster in an infant or small child. Pediatricians estimate infant small child's body will heat up 3 to 5 times faster than yours or mine would. So you and I can be sitting in a hot car, 120 degrees for 10 minutes. We're going to be super uncomfortable. A small infant could die in that time.
So that brings me to my next question, because I was looking at the deaths that have been recorded on your website. The first heat stroke death in a vehicle that you recorded this year, I mean, it happened back in February. It was in Alabama. It killed a 2-year-old, but the temperature was only 79 degrees. How does that happen?
Well, that was probably one of the biggest takeaways from the study was it doesn't have to be a super hot day for these deaths to occur. Let's say that 79 degree day, you're going to be in excess of 120 degrees after an hour inside that car, and so that is certainly a temperature that can cause a death. There was a case at the El Cerrito BART station here in the Bay Area. A few years back, where it was a 67-degree day. A child was accidentally left in the car for a number of hours and died from pediatric vehicular heat stroke. So that's a really important message. A hotter day causes these conditions to come on faster. But if a child is in a car for an extended period of time, even on a mild day, it can be deadly.
Mm. Finally, we only have a minute left. What legally can you do if you see a child or even an animal inside a vehicle?
So there are lots of Good Samaritan laws. California, I know, has one for pets. I'm not sure if we have one for leaving children. But in having done this for almost 20 years, I have never seen an instance of a person who got a child out of a hot car be prosecuted. They get citizens' awards. And so if you see a child in a hot car in any sort of distress, call 911, and if necessary, get that child out of the car.
Jan, thank you so much. It's really important information.
I'm glad I could share it with you.
Jen Nall is an adjunct professor of meteorology at San Jose State University and the founder of NoHeatStroke.org. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. A bill at the state capitol that would toughen penalties for someone convicted of trafficking a minor in California, it made national headlines, not so much for what the bill does, but for the reaction and backlash State Assembly Democrats received after initially killing the bill in its Public Safety Committee. In a legislature that is overwhelmingly run by the Democratic Party, it was a Republican senator who was able to declare victory on her bill, Senate Bill 14. But that was only after days of drama, vote reversals, and even a rare occurrence of Governor Newsom stepping in and supporting the GOP-authored bill. We'll speak with an advocate and expert on child trafficking in just a moment, but we're going to begin with CAP Radio politics reporter Nicole Nixon on the political tug of war. Hey, Nicole.
Good morning.
So what exactly would SB 14 do?
So it would classify trafficking of a minor as a serious felony or a strikeable offense. That's a legal classification for crimes that are subject to California's three strikes law. So if somebody's already been convicted of two serious felonies, they would automatically get a sentence of at least 25 years up to life in prison on a third conviction. And these are crimes like rape and murder, you know, burglary, violent crimes involving a gun. So this bill would add human trafficking of a minor to that list.
And the timing last week is pretty important, right? Because lawmakers just they broke for a month recess for the summer. So a lot had to happen last week. And this bill went under consideration in a Democrat controlled public safety committee in the assembly. So what happened?
Right. So the day that lawmakers recessed for a month for a summer break, there was a deadline for policy committees to pass all their bills. Because this bill failed on a Tuesday, you know, and then there was backlash on Wednesday. They called a special hearing on Thursday. You know, right before adjourning for a recess to get this bill passed to meet that deadline.
And who did you hear from? You have some sound to share.
Yeah. So the bill passed the Senate earlier this year, I will just note, without a single no vote. The author, Republican Senator Shannon Grove, she knew it would face some challenges in the Assembly Public Safety Committee. So she brought a human trafficking survivor and a former Alameda County District Attorney to testify in support of her bill. But another trafficking survivor came to speak against it. So here's April Grayson.
As a survivor, I can see the positive intent of this bill. However, as a survivor who has been criminalized and demonized by the legal system that was meant to protect me, I have to remind the authors in this committee that this bill, I'm so sorry, will actively harm many survivors of human trafficking, especially the Black, Brown, Native, Poor, LGBTQ women and trans survivors who are already least likely to see justice.
So April Grayson says even though she was victimized and trafficked, she was still sentenced to 20 years in prison. And the legal system didn't differentiate between her and her trafficker, so she had to sit next to him in court. Just a horrible experience. And Senator Grove said that she has actually changed the bill based on April Grayson's testimony. Her bill was previously classified trafficking as a violent felony. And Grove said, you know, what happened to Tanta Grayson was wrong, but because of criminal justice reforms and just more awareness generally about human trafficking, especially when it comes to minors, Grove says that what happened to April Grayson would very rarely or not happen these days. So here's Senator Shannon Grove.
I recognize her as a victim of human trafficking, a victim of the criminal justice system, but her story is very far and few between because of the criminal justice system reforms that we have today in our system. The laws have changed, and we're making sure that that never happens to another individual.
Okay, so given that the state senator made some revisions or amended the bill, you know, to try and close those potential shortcomings that can impact individual lives, why did Democrats in the committee, they chose not to allow the piece of legislation to move forward initially, and they got so much backlash. Why were they opposed?
Yeah, I think that was the question, especially knowing that this bill passed the Senate unanimously with a lot of, you know, progressive Democrats voting for it on that side. So most Democrats on these public safety committees, both in the Senate and Assembly, are pretty criminal justice reform minded. They are opposed to or at least very skeptical of raising criminal penalties. Assembly member Isaac Bryan is one of those members. He said during the hearing that California has just gotten it wrong on criminal penalties for years.
All evidence has shown that longer sentences don't actually stop things from happening. All they do is increase our investment in systems of harm and subjugation at the expense of the investments that the communities needed to not have this be a problem to begin with.
And Brian said he heard the testimony there of April Grayson. He was very concerned about victims getting caught up in this and being criminalized. It's very top of mind for him that people of color are disproportionately harmed by the criminal justice system. And there's also some debate here about how long convicted traffickers can go to prison. Some Democrats have argued that they can already face very long sentences under state criminal code. But a former district attorney has said that it's very rare and that in most cases a trafficker could get sentenced to 5 years on their first offense, but actually be out of prison within, you know, about 2 years.
Mm. Governor Newsom also got involved. I mean, he's a different arm of the branch. Is that unusual for the governor to step in for legislative matters?
Yeah, it's pretty unusual, I would say, for him to get involved in legislation he's not already sponsoring. He does, you know, support some legislation, but especially to weigh in on a bill from a Republican that's failed and have it come back. He told reporters that he actually called Senator Grove and told her that he wanted it to pass. The new Assembly Speaker, Robert Rivas, also got involved. And I think that pressure, you know, resulted in that bill getting that new emergency hearing just 48 hours after it had already failed.
And it moved forward.
Yeah. So lawmakers, like I said, they, you know, there was some parliamentary stuff that had to go down for this to happen. They met on Thursday. The plan was to adjourn after floor time, like 10 a.m. on a Thursday, and all go back to their districts for a month. So right before they were set to adjourn, you know, Democrats motioned to let this committee meet again to reconsider the bill. Republicans actually tried to force a vote directly there on the floor so everybody would be on the record there and then. The hearing did happen. It was a very interesting hearing because there was no author presentation, no witness testimony, no debate. The entire hearing lasted 90 seconds. I've never seen that happen. So it was just the vote and adjourned.
Wow.
And it passed.
Right, right. And this was a Republican-authored bill in an overwhelmingly Democrat-majority state legislature. Given that, like, there are members of this public safety committee that are largely Democrats, they say that longer prison sentences are not the answer, tougher penalties are inequitable. You know, there's this focus on rehabilitation, but it didn't stick this time. What do you think ultimately forced the hand of lawmakers to move this bill forward?
Well, I think it helped that the governor got involved and the speaker got involved. I don't think the Democratic caucus was actually prepared for the backlash to this. I mean, it was on, it made national headlines within a day. And I will say that, you know, criminal justice is a very nuanced conversation, but killing a bill to increase penalties for child trafficking was not a good look for the Democrats. And this is just the kind of victory that Republicans have been wanting to get in California when it comes to criminal justice. On the other side, though, the chair of the committee said that many of the members of the committee that had voted against the bill or not voted for the bill in the first place ended up receiving, you know, death threats and just horrible things as well. So this got this whole thing got very heated very quickly.
Mm. What did Republican lawmakers have to say?
Well, they talked about, you know, this being the kind of victory that they wanted to be. They're taking credit for getting this bill passed. They're pushing for tighter criminal penalties. The Assembly Republican leader called it a failed criminal justice approach, and he called for a return to law and order. So here's more from him, Assembly Member James Gallagher of Sutter County.
The pendulum has to swing back to a reasonable middle where we are actually protecting the people of this state, where the Public Safety Committee is actually concerned about the safety of the public. And I think a message was sent today. We are seeing a turn here. It started here today. The public pressure is building, and we're going to continue this fight. We're not letting up.
Nicole, you've joined us in the past about these kind of legislative 180s in the last session. I mean, some involve fentanyl bills that the Assembly Public Safety Committee initially, they didn't want them to move forward. They reversed course for similar reasons and backlash. You know, there are political implications to this. There was a San Francisco Chronicle, an op-ed piece, and this was last week. There were lots of them, but I'm just using this one as an example. And I'm curious if you're hearing the same thing around the Capitol. The headline read that California Democrats are taking absurd positions on crime and housing. They're making Republicans somehow relevant again. Do you think some of these voters or votes could benefit Republicans down the line? We have a big election in 2024.
I think Republicans are really hoping that's the case. I think it will remain to be seen. I don't think the discussion on fentanyl is over. You know, they're doing some things on the periphery. They did decline to move any bills to increase penalties for dealing fentanyl. But they're doing things like a task force, making naloxone more available in schools and things like that. So I guess, you know, there is an election coming up and we'll see.
Nicole, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Nicole Nixon is Cap Radio's politics reporter. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio, and we're talking about Senate Bill 14, which would add longer sentences and stiffen penalties for anyone convicted of child trafficking in California. So we just heard about all the political drama last week over the bill. Now we want to bring in Ashley Bryant, the co-founder of Three Strands Global Foundation. That is a nonprofit based in El Dorado County, which focuses on ending human trafficking, and they are a sponsor of SB 14. Good morning, Ashley.
Good morning, Vicki. So nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, your organization sponsored SB 14. What was your reaction to how the process worked out last week to get it out of the Public Safety Committee?
Yeah, it was a really interesting day. You know, we have sponsored legislation before mandating trafficking in schools back in 2017. But this was a really interesting committee meeting, especially when all of the committee members abstained the first time around, the Democrats in voting. We were disappointed, but hearing from the governor and then hearing back from the committee that they would rehear and reconsider the bill was a good moment for us. So we're glad that it moved forward and it's headed to appropriations, and we'll hopefully continue to get to the governor's desk.
And this is just a very important point or a reason to bring up and learn more about trafficking and how it happens in the United States and California, but specifically in our area. Your nonprofit is founded in El Dorado County in El Dorado Hills. How prevalent is human trafficking here?
Yeah, I think it's super important for us to have this conversation right now because we want to debunk myths, right? This is not taken. This is not the sensationalization that has happened quite frequently in the media and in movies and such. This is really our vulnerable populations that are being coerced. There's fraud and even force, but the force component of it is not as seen as much in the crime of human trafficking as fraud and coercion is. And so it's important for us in the anti-trafficking movement to really communicate that this is commercial sexual exploitation, which is sex trafficking, and or forced labor. Those are really the two types of trafficking that we focus in on in the United States. And in California, we know that trafficking is actually happening. We are one of the top three states in the nation where human trafficking has high numbers. And we also know that the average age between 15 and 17 is what the U.S. Department of State tells us is happening. In Sacramento specifically, I think it's important for us to talk about the fact that this is a crime that hides in plain sight. So when we think about trafficking, it is not, as I said, a stranger that comes and grabs someone off the street. It is more likely that it is happening with our vulnerable populations, and our vulnerable populations, those being those who are impoverished or homeless, those who have or LGBTQIA, those that might have vulnerable things that are happening to them, a disability that traffickers exploit. And that often happens through coercion, that happens with the connection, whether that be online or in person. And then that trafficker exploits that vulnerability in order to actually traffic either through commercial sex or forced labor that individual.
Did your organization, your nonprofit, begin because either you or someone in your organization has been touched by trafficking and wanted to do something to stop it?
Yeah, absolutely. It did. And you know, I'll start with, we are really fortunate at Three Strands to have reached 864 plus individuals who we call clients, who are survivors and place them into sustainable jobs and or education, and almost a million kids through our prevention education program called Protect. But this agency began because my good friend's daughter was trafficked. And that that really brought to the forefront this idea of how do we lean in and what can we do to prevent human trafficking in the first place. And so Three Strands has really focused on prevention and say we exist to prevent human trafficking really missionally so that we can stop the crime before it starts. Mm.
Given that your focus obviously is focused on victims of human trafficking and sex trafficking, what do you make of the argument from Assembly Member Isaac Bryan? He's a Democrat, you know, about the argument that he tweeted this, but Nicole touched upon it as well, that the people most vulnerable to being charged with trafficking are the victims of trafficking themselves. Charges are used to leverage their cooperation and prosecution, and their survivor status is erased, with many currently incarcerated in both youth and adult prisons. And we heard from that example, from that woman's testimony earlier, that happened to her. Are you concerned that this bill can continue to do that?
Yeah, no, I think that it's really important to have this conversation. Criminal justice needs to happen, right? And at the same time, we need traffickers to be held accountable so survivors can move forward with their lives. I think that's really important. I just shared with you that, you know, we have actually placed, and both in services as well as in jobs, sustainable jobs, over 800 survivors. And in those stories, I think it's really important for us to be listening to our lived experience experts and where things are happening, what's happening now. So when we talk about criminal justice reform, and specifically this bill, actually it relates just to minors. Most of our clients are 16 years old and up. So, but as this one relates to minors, I think one of the things we have to remember is that this is a bill that really allows for affirmative defense or vacature, right? So if there is someone that we know is a survivor who has been victimized in some way, but then also is a part of the trafficker's recruitment, then we want that survivor to actually have that sentence vacated if they were arrested, right? Now, in part of what the reporter Nicole was talking about is that, and even April talked about it in her testimony, she was criminalized. That should never happen. Ever. And we see as advocates that the tide has changed. And not only law enforcement, but anti-trafficking organizations, victim service advocates are all recognizing with a trauma-informed lens, victims and lived experience expert survivors for who they are and not to criminalize them. We want the traffickers criminalized. We want those who are exploiting and taking advantage of the vulnerabilities that I mentioned earlier. We want them to actually be held accountable for the crime that they have committed. And so for survivors, we want them to be elevated. We want lived experience experts to be in this discussion, which for the last 13 years, Three Strands has been in those conversations. And that's why when we saw this bill from Senator Grove, we felt like this is a great bill to be able to sponsor and get behind, to tell the truth about human trafficking, but also to be able to hold traffickers accountable.
Ashley, thank you for the time and your work.
Thank you so much, Vicki.
Ashley Bryan is the co-founder of Three Strands Global Foundation, that is a nonprofit based in El Dorado County with a focus on ending human trafficking. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. For more than half a century, musicians and music lovers have gathered in the Sierra Nevada each summer for what is believed to be the oldest cultural event in Alpine County. The Bear Valley Music Festival kicks off this Friday and is celebrating 55 years of music among some of the most breathtaking scenery in our state. Held in the charming community of Bear Valley, the festival has attracted notable guests over the years, including Glenn Campbell, Roseanne Cash, the Mamas and the Papas, and more. Joining us now to tell us more about this summer tradition is Priscilla Call Essert with the Bear Valley Music Festival. Priscilla, welcome to Insight. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Thank you for having me on the show.
You know, I loved learning that this has been an annual tradition since 1968. What is the origin story of the Bear Valley Music Festival?
That's a great question. So there were some absolute music lovers here when this community got built in 68. And a lot of those people still live here, multiple generations. But they were music lovers. And they said, hey, I think it's time for us to have some music filling this valley. It's so beautiful. It originally started out as mostly classical. Over the years, it's embraced opera. And then eventually they added the rock, pop, jazz portions to it. And it's just gone strong for 55 years. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, and Alpine County, it's actually California's least populated county with approximately 1,200 residents. I've been to, you know, Markleyville and, you know, or heading down on my drive down to the Eastern Sierra. It's actually not that far from Tahoe. It's a very reasonable drive from Sacramento. And I love that the first year of this festival, that residents, they actually opened up their homes to musicians and meals were served family style at the Bear Valley Lodge. How do you keep and retain that welcoming spirit and that atmosphere alive today, you know, more than 50 years later?
That's a great question. Again, for instance, this summer, I have three or four interns who grew up with this festival, and their grandparents, you know, would bring them up here. And people are just so welcoming. They want this festival to succeed. It's become a part of the fiber of this entire community. They open up their homes to the musicians. They open up their hearts to the musicians. They pitch in on so many levels, donating their rooms and their homes. The generosity is just amazing. And it all flows from this commitment to having this incredible festival in this incredible location. And they all know it takes a village to put it on because, you know, it's a small community. There's not a ton of infrastructure, but it's partly what makes it charming. You know, it's really, it is part of the community, part of the nature of this area. I mean, it's just incredible when you look at the tent, you see it backing up to the beautiful trees and the boulders. And it's just amazing, the spirit of this community. And you can feel it and see it and how people open up to the musicians as they arrive here in the valley.
When were you first touched and by the music festival? Because now you're deeply involved in it and keeping it going.
I am deeply involved in it. I attended several years ago as a member of the audience, and I've had several friends over the years who have spent as many as 15, 20 years playing in the festival. I'm a flute player. I actually never played in Bear Valley Music Festival, but I did attend. And I attended last summer, not knowing that this summer I would be running this thing. But I've just heard such incredible things from musicians over the years who have participated and just how special this is. It is a very unique festival. There's so many great festivals. I mean, I've been involved with Aspen Music Festival, Music of the Mountains, many festivals. This is so unique, partly because of the location and partly the natural beauty, the lack of population here in Alpine County, like you said, but also, again, the people who live here who are so committed to this festival.
And this weekend, or this festival, it spans 3 weekends, correct? And it starts this weekend.
Yes. Yes, it kicks off this Friday with the English Beat. We're really excited that they're here. It's almost sold out now. How many seats left? So it kicks off with the English Beat, and the classical portion kicks off on the 27th with something we haven't done. Our conductor, Alexandra Micklethwaite's very visionary and is bringing lots of new ideas and energy to the festival. The 27th, what we're doing that we've not done before is bringing in a Paul McCartney tribute band, and the orchestra will kick off the classical section in this performance with Live and Let Die. So it's pretty exciting to see how that's going to work. We're looking forward to that. And then after the 27th, the Live and Let Die, we go into, you know, our various purely classical sections. But that Thursday, the 27th, is sort of a hybrid of the orchestra sort of entering into this tribute band's world. We're very excited about it.
And over the decades, this festival, I mean, you're talking about classical music, you know, full symphony orchestra, but it's evolved since then as well and has incorporated a pretty wide variety of genres of music and performances.
Oh, yes. I mean, this summer alone, like I said, we start out with the English Beat. We're going to a tribute band the concert's going to be one part, first half will be Steely Dan, second half Chicago. That's pretty amazing. Crosby, Stills, Nash, Young tribute band. I'm really excited about the Lawrence Hobgood trio. It's a really special jazz night. And then we go into some incredible stuff that sort of creates a nod to the 1968 where we started. So for instance, we have a sitar player coming from San Rafael. He's a world-renowned sitar player, Arjun Verma, and he's going to be doing a symphony by Ravi Shankar. And, you know, Shankar was an amazing composer that just really crossed over between classical Indian music and here music traditions in the West. So it's pretty special, and it's definitely a nod to the 1960s. So we're excited about that.
Yeah, I can totally understand why some of these performances are already sold out, and you're going to have a pretty great crowd over a 3-weekend span. How many people do you typically welcome each summer?
That's a great question. Our capacity in the tent, except for the very first opening night, which is a little larger than normal because we're making room for dancing. So we took out
that's very important.
But yeah, 500 people per concert will come in. And we have some great food options for people and wine, beer, beverages before, so they can come up, picnic under, you know, by the boulders and roll into a 7 o'clock performance. We do have one matinee I'd love to share with Mountain Matinee. Is it's free for kids 17 and under, and it's a program that really has kids in mind. They can wiggle, they can move, they can do what they need to do to sit and be immersed in this incredible place and have a musical experience. And there'll be art activities afterwards, put on by Arts of Bear Valley. So we try to build bridges between other groups here doing things in other areas of the arts, and Mountain Matinee is a perfect example of that. So and it's a very kid-friendly event. We're looking forward to that.
I'm hanging on the 500 people in the tent because I've been to large music festivals. I've also been to really small ones as well, and when it comes to small ones, there's such a special intimate atmosphere that really adds to how you enjoy a music festival. And you have obviously a lot of experience with music festivals as well. I would imagine people leave this music festival each summer, if it's their first time, getting a pretty different experience if they were to go to something really big where you have like 100,000 people.
Yeah, very different. It's much more intimate, which is beauty of it. And what I also love is our conductor, one of his sweet spots is really connecting with the audience. And so you have this intimate setting and this conductor who just has this gift for bringing people into, you know, what to listen for in a piece, what's special about it, how to engage. And it's he just meets people exactly where they are and brings them into the experience in a really special way. I've worked with a lot of different conductors, and he just has this very special gift that matches perfectly this intimate gathering. You people can come as they are in their hiking clothes. They don't have to be, you know, trained in classical music to feel they have access to this, to these concerts. It's just so amazing, very all-embracing, so.
Well, Priscilla, thank you for joining us. I know it's a very busy week, but you're going to have a great time.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your time, and have a lovely day. Thank you.
Priscilla Kahl-Essert is the executive director of the Bear Valley Music Festival in Alpine County. It begins this Friday, and it runs through August 6th. And that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and Victor Corral Martinez, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Antonio Munez. Our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great Tuesday. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.